Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
As an artist, I have no single vision, no obsession. I wait quietly for a stunning, pleasing vision to present itself. My paintings celebrate that great breath which is ecstatic freedom. They celebrate the stunning beauty of the sweet light that reappears every morning. They celebrate just plain being alive.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm Hildegard Keller, and I give
WFHB.
WFHB?
Yes.
Hereby, formally, joyfully, permission to record me.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, so we can just jump right in then if you're ready to jump in. Mm-hmm. Or I can read these if you'd like me to read these so you can hear it.
Yeah, why don't you?
All right. I'll do that. Welcome to Interchange. I'm Doug Storm. Tonight's program is a pre-recorded conversation with literary critic and author and filmmaker Hildegard Elizabeth Keller, who teaches German literature at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Keller's most recent project, the film Whatever Comes Next, was shown at the IU Cinema on April 26th. This is a documentary about local painter and scholar Anne-Marie Mahler. Born in Vienna in 1926, Mahler fled by herself as a 12-year-old to the United States and since 1955 has lived in Bloomington, Indiana, and in the summers in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. The documentary portrays the artist's outer and inner lives, which bridge two centuries and two continents. Welcome to Interchange, Hildegard Keller.
Thank you very much.
How did you come to know Anne-Marie Mahler existed, let alone that she would be an interesting subject for a film?
Well, obviously, that's the first question, I understand. I came to Bloomington in January 2008, and quickly after, I was taken to a marvelous club. It's called the Faculty Drama Club. It's a big kind of association of friends and people who know each other and enjoy company and enjoy a piece of theater. And that is being read out loud in the living room of someone. So someone is the producer, others are in the cast, and even others are prepare the snacks. So that was... I think that was the first occasion I got to know her, and then also nearly simultaneously, I observed her attend the workshops or lectures when we had an event with the Medievalia at the Lilly. That's a series we ran, with the holdings of the Lilly Library here on campus. I ran that series with Cherry Williams, the manuscript curator. So there she would show up too, very often. Because she's a scholar and very interested in medieval things.
So you met her there, and what was it that interested you enough to think maybe this would be a person I should explore as a subject in a film?
You know, I initially had an idea of a whole series of portraits of interesting, quirky minds, curious minds, alive and passed away from Bloomington, because as an outsider in Bloomington, I have a fresh view, I think. So, and she was the first one in this series, and then it turned out to become a bigger project. She immediately struck me as a strong, forceful personality. And with time, we formed a friendship. And I would visit her, she would visit me. And later on, at some point, she came up or she suggested considering if I put up a show with her paintings in Switzerland, in Zurich, my other place. Because she had a very close relationship, or has a very close relationship to Switzerland. She loves the Alps, she loves skiing, and with her husband, she, I think did a few times they were in Switzerland and closed us to, for skiing weeks, or research weeks, however you put that. And, well, that turned out, yes, I felt she has trust in me, obviously. But the idea with an exhibit never really turned out. I couldn't pursue it because those are, yeah, for a host of reasons, practical reasons mostly. And later on, towards the end of 2012, at the beginning of 2013, some other strands in my work and in my creative thinking came together. So all of a sudden, there was this this idea of making the film about her. She has still this power of youth in her, and you feel it when she tells her stories. And that attracts people. That attracted me, too.
Is there a way that you being from Switzerland, being not from this country, resonates with you, with her own story? You're coming here. Is there a sense that you have that in common?
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, there are a host of other more biographical reasons. And coming to a new country, we certainly have in common the topic of emigration. Yes, to integrate, to get to know people, to come to terms also with who am I here? Who am I there? Who was I? Who am I here and who will I become?
When I came to Bloomington, this was a secret. This was a wonderful place that people didn't realize, an island in other whatever, you know. But then we truly fell in love with it. They took us to the music school, to the opera, which was something called East Hall in those days, and it was wonderful. And we met the most wonderful people, many of them refugees from Germany and Austria, especially in the music school, of course. And we just never felt like leaving here because here, this is where the friends are. This is home, and I love it.
That thread of emigrating and leaving something behind and winning something, gaining new opportunities, we have that in common. And then she is from the generation of my parents. My parents were Germans, and they immigrated also into Switzerland. So still very much that feeling of my parents have left a country that was destroyed in the Second World War and had to do this process of assimilation in Switzerland. When this idea of making a film with her, and I say really with her, not just about her, when this idea condensed, it was very clear to me that despite of the topic of emigration, of exile, having to leave the hometown behind, this would not be a film about adversity, and especially the adversities we're speaking of in the 20th century. But this would be, I would emphasize her as an artist, a forceful personality, an original personality that would face face things that were on her path. And of course, there are adversities in everyone's life. And they inform your identity because they help to bring out, in the best case, the best things in you. Talents, new perspectives. You open up and you become a different person.
In 1938, Austria ceased to exist and became part of Nazi Germany. With one brutal blow, a thrilling moment in Vienna's cultural life had been eviscerated, trampled, exiled. My mother and my aunt are in a taxi on our way to the railroad station. In the dark, we ride through the same streets that I have rushed through so many times in the early morning on my way to school. The darkness of the streets is broken only by dim rectangles of light in windows, bright spots of light from street lamps, moving spots of light from automobiles. I have a small suitcase with the clothes I will need in Holland and a bag of sandwiches and fruit for the train. It will take a night and a day and part of another night to travel through Austria and Germany to get to the Dutch border. After disconnected farewells, I go up the steps with my things and find the right compartment, and then I crowd at the window with the other children. Groups of grown-ups are standing on the platform, looking with rigid faces, starting to wave. Then the train slowly pulls out of the station. It is over now. We have left danger. We have left home. At that moment, home, Austria, Vienna, became an imaginary place. Now, finally, I want to paint a portrait of when it was mine.
So this take on whatever comes next, that's why it's the title also. Something looking forward. What's coming towards me? What is new issues, new options I can integrate and I can react on and I can interact with them. So that's what's very much in the center of the film. I took the title from Anne-Marie's words. She describes this moment of being open in the morning at some point after the awakening and everything comes back, the consciousness, the tasks of the day. I think this is a really important motif for her life, for her attitude towards life, but it was very important also for the whole making of the film, whatever comes next, because we did it kind of step by step. And then it is a topic for myself, and I think for everyone. Whatever comes next, isn't that the general old philosophical question, where do I come from, where do I stand now, and where am I headed next?
Tell us a little bit about how you put the film together. It's a little bit biopic, a little bit about creativity, a little bit about her process as an artist, but it's also about your process as an artist. And so tell us a little bit how you merge all those in there.
Yes, I think there is as a general difference between a feature film and a documentary, I think you can point out that you can script a feature perfectly, and then you shoot it, and then you edit it how it was written, more or less, and you have as many takes as you need. You can't do that with the documentary, much less with her, because at some point she would say, I'm not an actress, and then another point, yes, she had said what she wanted to say, and that was it. So you couldn't go back. And anyways, script a personality like Anne-Marie's, that's, I don't know. I don't have an analogy, but it's too vivid, too much of a flow in her thoughts just to rewind. So yes, we had the material at some point. And it was very incalculable what would come out after the shoot. And even after that, how would we build the storyline? And that was one of the major tasks in post-production, which was in Switzerland. With that task, we started and we put a lot of imagination and heart in it. How should we structure this material until we found like a chapter structure, which we gave titles like car, bear, new bird, or ice, or trout. So it's like, it's also a little bit like in a picture book.
The titles are related to something in her art or something that she talks about during the film?
Both, yes, yes.
Is there anything other than just an interview with a subject?
Yes, there is much more in it. We wanted not only to do, let's say, to represent the physical outer world in real footage, interviews with her in the different places, in her studio, in both of her studios, in Woods Hole and in Bloomington. We also wanted to take you as a viewer onto an inner journey through her thoughts. And some of them are rooted in time, like childhood memories. Others are not. Others are about the artistic process, how she conceives it. So I could we built a second level with specific visual means, with miniature figures, musical, with a musical core that would enhance this world. And we used her writings, passages of her writings with a voiceover.
I wonder if there's a way that we're trying to figure out what is documentary as in what's true and false, or what's fictive or what's creative or how we can create, you know, or how you as an artist or as a filmmaker create something that isn't just about Anne-Marie Mahler.
I think it is very clear that this is not a documentary in an ordinary sense. It's a different kind of documentary. It's a hybrid form, and I'm not even sure how to really name it. I think the most important thing is the means of storytelling, and in that other layer, let's say, which is not the real physical world that is represented just because she sits in her sofa and tells a story. We have that other layer, and in that layer, I had a sort of a Alice in Wonderland approach. You shift dimensions also. We shift to figurines that are very, very tiny. We had major challenges in the camera work to do this with extreme macro shots. We wanted to find a surrounding for these words that were from a different realm. It's not just words about the physical world. It's about what she experiences, but mostly, even more so, what is her reflection? How she expresses what she observes. And she likes to do that. And she does it wonderfully well.
Narrative is by definition dynamic, never really at rest. It is about people walking the tightrope through time, shifting precariously from one imbalance to the next, always in the course of incomplete action, never really at rest. I want peace, quiet contemplation.
This is Interchange on WFHB. I'm Doug Storm. I'm joined by critic, author, and filmmaker Hildegard Keller to discuss her recently released documentary, Whatever Comes Next, a portrait of local scholar and artist, 89-year-old Anne-Marie Mahler. When you're doing a film that is a biopic, that the subject herself conceives to be a movie about her, in what ways does that relationship between you as the filmmaker who has a creative vision for the film and the subject, you know, in what ways does that create a kind of tension when you're trying to make something that fits your particular artistic vision but may or may not fit the subject's artistic vision or vision of herself?
I would not have introduced the figurines if that had been an ordinary documentary, just a painter wants to be represented in a biopic, that's it. That's not what I wanted. That wasn't my artistic vision either. And I think it's not conform with the message of the film, which is also a message about how to live a life in general, in more general terms. This goes beyond. This movie's bigger than just Anne-Marie Mahler's circumstances and her life. It comes through that. I needed it to express other viewpoints, more inner viewpoints with her words. That's why I introduced this other narrative. It's just one figure, one other narrative figure, which is an alter ego of hers. Maybe a child ego, but also a timeless ego. Often it sits on a bench. It contemplates. It contemplates an inner cinema with historical footage, or it contemplates ice, how ice is melting down. And this whole process of memory has to do also with melting memories. She speaks about that too. So I did have this vision, and even if I felt some not a totally positive response on her side, I wanted to pursue with that, because I was convinced of it, and I wanted to try that storytelling, that method of storytelling. I wanted to try it out. That was my challenge on my side.
You have what you would, I assume, have a sort of standard biopic perspective, where you see her, she speaks, she talks about what she's doing, she may actually be creating things, and you talk about it. You see her life, you see her house, you see her studio, you see
her dog.
You see her car, you see Bloomington, you see Woods Hole as well.
Yes.
So in a sense, you are sort of traveling through the life of Anne-Marie Mahler as she goes about her day, basically.
Everyday life. Yes.
As an 89-year-old, or now currently an 89-year-old woman artist, we see her in a daily routine frequently. But within there, you also find a way to almost comment on her life, her work, her expressions of who she is herself,
yes,
within that second level you're talking about.
Yes, that's nice how you put that. And just to repeat that, I do that with her own words. So she's a good writer. She has autobiographic writing, so I used excerpts from that writing. I made a selection of that, and that's like a comment on her life by herself, but from a different perspective. And that's why I did not use just images of herself or footage of herself, but I used this figurine.
I think now in a lot of neuroscience literature, they've been talking a lot about, this isn't new to think about things this way, but just sort of instability of identity over time and our memories of who we were, and understanding that we may not be that person anymore. Such things like this sort of create a fictive sense of ourselves,
yeah,
anyway, right?
Yeah.
So it's nice that you bring that into the film that way.
Yeah.
Besides those kinds of visual, the sort of visual aspects of creating little figurines, just one figurine, or are there you said it was a single.
It's actually just a single. It's a girl.
So it's a girl.
At some point comes a boy.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
My brother was sent to private school, and when I graduated from high school, my father sent me to learn shorthand and typing. But in the end, I'm the one who got the doctorate. It comes to mind when I think about the differential treatment people got depending on whether they were girls or boys. I always wished I could be a boy, not that I wanted to, all that equipment, that didn't interest me. But they were allowed to do things, they were respected, and we were allowed to serve them, be charming, have children, cook. I love to cook, there's nothing wrong with cooking. And, well, okay, let's go back to work.
So there's a girl figurine and a tiny little miniature that you film with just regular digital cameras or okay. So you're filming this little.
It is in a way, yes. We developed a specific kind of construction with the lens. That was Carter Ross's work on that. The director of photography, it was great to work with him because he likes technical challenges. And I, on my side, I had experimented with that technique in photography, just sheer photography, not moving images, for a number of years on my deck with flowers and fruits and lots of stuff. I have a whole population. So I knew a lot about lighting and angles and how to make the most, how to bring out the best effect of a specific point of view.
So these are actual posed figurines, or are there figurines that are often transposed through the magic of digital photography? Or do you actually have figurines on things that
we had a set. I built a set, and I was the lighting assistant, and the set was on a table, and so South Park Avenue was a film studio at some point.
Very nice. Are there other ways in which you tried to tell the story that you were trying to tell beyond the visual?
Oh yeah. On that level we are speaking about, that alter ego level, with comments about life, about childhood, about art, we developed a specific way of a specific music for that, because that world had to resound in a very specific way. And post-production and the original score was done in Switzerland by composer Olaf Lervig and his friend, the cellist Ivan Tokali. So at the beginning, we have a lot of piano, but that I felt immediately that's too big. Piano, classical usual piano sound was too big for that tiny, different Alice in Wonderland-ish landscape, and also I like to say lifescape. So we tried literally also with electronic means to squeeze the music, to make it smaller, to make it bigger, to make it to open up different spaces in hearing. Sometimes we would add sounds that had to do with the visual, like, for example, the melting of the ice. So we recorded the melting of the ice, and we blend that in. Or sometimes I had some specific kind of sound in mind, and I would tell Olaf, why don't you go in that direction? So he developed something in that direction, and we worked on that, and we took it from there. It was a whole interesting process to find transitions from real-life physical world, interviews with Anna-Marie herself about her paintings, back into that other level. Sometimes you would hear like little tunnels for the ear, like a tunnel when you come out of the dark into light again. So you have a tunnel where you come from real world into that inner world.
This is the opera, this open house, and this is the way... This is the center of Vienna somehow, in lots of ways, and you can easily always find it. And here, this is the Draga. So this is the school that I went to. And when I met Henry Mahler at Berkeley, it turned out that he had gone to the same school.
We both hated and loved Austria, and we never had to explain anything at all to each other. With a refugee's inevitable sense of inferiority, we each would have preferred to marry someone unlike ourselves, a WASP from a good old American family. But we meant home to each other, then and always.
Is there a sense in which you came to want to create a kind of psychological portrait that isn't necessarily a psychology of Anne-Marie, but is a psychology of the artist, a psychology of this creation of yours? Anne-Marie Mahler becomes a creation, but it is the creation of yours that has a sort of psychology within the film.
Well, if you want to say that, let's say, Doug, if you had made a film about her, it might be a very different film. Oh, yes. Most certainly, yes. I worked with my means, I worked with my crew, I started out with my vision, with my previous experiences that I brought in. Yes, that's true. I don't think I would call it psychological. I like to call it more maybe philosophical, or just in a very broad, wide sense, it's about life and about how you can be in the midst of everyday life, and there is some underlying pattern that carries you forth. That's why I said before, I like this theme of whatever comes next. What's on my way now? What experience is here and now, today? How will that shape me? How can I react on that? What kind of interaction it brings with me and the world? And world, I mean... That can be an inner impulse, that can be something that comes from outside. And that pattern of a power, a force that shapes you and informs you and brings you forth and makes who you are and transforms who you are. As you said before, I'm a different person with 40 than with 20, and with 80 a different than with 60, and not necessarily more solid. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense that that Anne-Marie Mahler as well has a sense that she is an 89-year-old artist, and that's very different than the little girl she was when she began creating, that she's gone through these stages also and become different people along the way?
I do think she's well aware of that. And at the same time, yet that I have found that always very interesting how vivid all those memories are. For example, that one of the key experiences with her, and I could resonate a lot with that, when she was in kindergarten. And... Yeah, she had certainly gotten some attention from her parents. Why wouldn't she? But still, that attention could be more specific for her. So one day she comes out of kindergarten and she had created something. And I think that's her first memory of creating something and the response from outside. Because she comes home, people see, I don't know, the mother or whoever saw what she had done. And they say, shout. schau, was das Kind kann. So you see what the child can do. And she says in the film, with wide open eyes, she says, and all of a sudden I became a three-dimensional human being. Mm. And this moment of you pop, you explode within yourself. I mean, in the eyes of other people, you grow by creation. Of course, that's something that's, let's say, mirrored from outside. But I think by the time she experienced in herself, she does it for herself.
It's pretty young to sort of come to that realization, right?
Right. But again, Doug, I mean, here we are talking about memories, and memories are not necessarily what was real, raw life. I mean, that's shaped with a retrospective view, but that's how she remembers it. And that makes her, I think, in some ways, it's what makes her also so young, because you still have that feeling of the girl who says, "Schau, was das Kind kann," and then she opens her wide, blue, beautiful eyes.
That bird is very sure of itself. Very sure of itself. Somebody tried to buy it, and somehow I said, "No, I don't think so." It's the only one I did with a bird on top in the car. Usually my birds are in houses. That bird means I'm a free person, and a bird is riding with me. I can't really explain it, but you've seen that I've got birds on houses in several paintings. And it just makes me feel good. I'm leaving now. There you go. I don't care what I leave behind. I am free. I am going to wherever, whatever there is. I'll manage it. That's what that bird says. But I'll take my good dog along, because I wouldn't leave her behind.
It's time for a break. I'm Doug Storm, and this is Interchange on WFHB. We've been speaking with Hildegard Keller, a professor of German literature at Indiana University, whose latest project, a documentary film about local painter and scholar Anna Marie Mahler, was presented recently at IU Cinema. We've been talking about how the theme of immigration unites Mahler and Keller. When we return, we'll talk about some of the ways that Keller uses elements of the film, like music and voice-over narration, to reveal something unconscious in the process of creation. Welcome back to Interchange on WFHB. I'm Doug Storm. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Hildegard Keller, who has recently completed and begun showing her film about local artist 89-year-old Anna Marie Mahler, Whatever Comes Next. Our last segment focused on what interested Keller about Mahler so much that she decided to make a film about her. For this segment, we'll try to explore the process of making the film, and we'll look at its major themes. And we'll conclude with what came before this film for Keller and what she's working on next. In talking about the sort of creative process in the film and having a previous history of your own in terms of creativity, what are some of those previous things that you've done that sort of seem to have led up into this project?
From Christmas to Christmas, my only wish was a box of pencils, and I would draw them away in 1 year, and I was saving them. You know, I was drawing that was the way, my only way of actually having a little bit of a privacy in my mind was sitting on a table with a paper and my pencils, because it was all a hubbub around. Mm. Very small, tiny apartment with seven persons, cramped. So this, for me, creativity had even a sort of, being just creating out drawing. Drawing had like a saving, cutting out the space, an imaginary space. I think I've always been, from early on, at least I remember as a teenager, I was very performative, and I had this performative drive all the time. I loved acting. I did theater in my high school. There was a theater group, and later on I did puppet theater and drawing and collage work, graphic stuff. And later on, I would use theater and performative things, also audio plays or different forms. I would use in school as a pedagogic tool. And later on, even in the university, which is not the ideal sphere for such adventures. But I found this space. Sometimes it was a hidden space. I started out with that. As a medievalist, I teach literature, which is all about storytelling, by the way. I mean, and a lot of it is about performative means, because at that time you still didn't have any technology. Your body, your voice, your eyes, your gestures, those were the tools to tell a story, or to preach, or to sing, or to do a ritual, a sacred ritual, or whatever. It was all body-centered. So I always thought, I'm not that wrong in that field, you know? And to work with the students to reenact those texts, I loved very much. And I saw how they reacted, how positively they reacted, because in a way, it's a stuffy world. There's a lot of dust there on that parchment. So I felt a little bit of a fresh breeze wouldn't hurt. And I started out with audio productions, audio plays, actually in conjunction with exhibits about medieval manuscripts. A dear colleague of mine asked me to do recordings of the texts that were on the page. So you could look at the page, and at the same time you could hear that strange sound, that language of 800 years ago, you know, as if some ghost would pop up and say, yeah, and read out aloud that page. And from there, I started writing my own audio plays, also with the Mystics, and that led to a major production in 2011. I called it The Trilogy of the Timeless. It's a trilogy, it's three volumes, tiny, nice volumes, nicely done, with texts and images, and they contain CDs. And on those CDs, I staged audio plays with different personalities from the great spiritual heritage of Europe. Well, actually even beyond Europe, but most of them are Europeans. Mysticism is about union of God and the soul. And it can be a very abstract thing. Like if you think of Master Eckhart, he's one of them. He's in the volume about the camel. But it can be also very passionate, very poetic. If you think of certain women like Hadewig or even Mechthild von Magdeburg, they were troubadours. They were passionate lovers of God. And they saw themselves as lovers, brides of God. It was an erotic conception. I and God, I'm in a love relationship. So you have some very different but not easily accessible realms of that great spiritual heritage. And I wanted to develop a way how to convey that to normal people outside of academia, because there is a lot of thirst, hunger on that front in Europe.
So the Trilogy of the Timeless is the project you were talking about, where it has the three volumes.
Three books. Let's name it three books. The same kind of design, very nicely done. And when you open them, they have a pocket, or some have two or even three pockets with a CD in it. And on that CD, you have audio plays. So what's in the book and what's on the CD is complementary. One is, let's say, factual information, if you want to know something about the persons who are speaking on the CD. And the CD contains a fictitious encounter of certain of these personalities. One CD is with the two old masters, the two old masterminds, Master Eckhart and Zhuangzi, one of the founders of Taoism. The other CD is with four women, four great female voices between the 12th century and the 20th century. And I called it Trilogy of the Timeless because I thought, for these minds, we can dissolve time and space. They meet and have common themes, love, personal love, interpersonal love, love of God. What is this God actually that they experienced? So their deepest depth they experienced in their life. They try to convey this to each other.
So this is in the audio plays that you created. Are these just texts that you had pulled from these various people and, you know, put them next to each other so they become dialogic? Or did you make up some of this stuff? Is this your creation as well?
Well, on the CD, you have audio plays, and they are scripted and staged with actors and all. So that's a creation of my own. I was the director. Yes, I wrote it and I staged it with them. And if you ask me what is the text itself, the play, the script, that is, again, yes, I wanted to convey Master Eckhart's thought, so I extracted passages. But then I also needed transitions, of course, because it was a conversation between the two. And they needed to react on each other, to interact with, maybe to deny or to become more curious. It was a real play. I wrote that. But of course, I did not want, for example, to make up like a Master Eckhartist sound. Yeah, I took it and tried to adapt it into a script that would be easily or relatively easily accessible, because it was something you could just eavesdrop on that conversation.
So in a sense, you have what you would call scholarly apparatus in terms of one aspect of the project, and then something more creative or something more...
It's not a scholarly apparatus.
No.
The books contain chapters about those personalities, but not in a scholarly, difficult word. I mean, language. A language should be everyday language, with some additional chapters about common topics or so. In the book, you can get just the factual information about the persons as far as we know.
Okay.
Scholarly, up-to-date level of information. But the encounter, of course, is fictitious because they never met. I mean, for the Trilogy of the Timeless, I saw myself more like a servant because I think it's really too bad to leave all of this in the basement or in archives, in dusty archives, or again, as I say, in closets that are just the scholars have the key to those closets. Because it's so difficult to read Master Eckhart or even Hildegard of Bingen. It's difficult. That was my way, try to make them more, bring them more to life and bring the texts more to life.
You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm Doug Storm. I'm joined by critic, author, and filmmaker Hildegard Keller, who discusses her interest in medieval mystics, and the Argentine poet Alfonsino Storni. Well, tell us a little bit about the Argentinian poet that you've worked with. You've translated some prose of hers, Alfonsina Storni, and you're working on a biography about her as well right now.
Yes, that's another project, so I hope our audience won't be mixed up with all the different threads. That's the initial thread, and sometimes I have the feeling as if Alfonsina herself injects all that creative energy into my life.
She started it out for you? She was your muse, in a sense? Or
maybe. I think in myself I call her like that. Yeah. I started out to work on her soon after I came to Bloomington, because finally I thought I came here as a medievalist and in the German department, but still I said to myself, let's take a break now from the Middle Ages and let's take a break from the German sphere. And I'm also a trained Hispanist, so I got back to my previous life, which, Spanish was important. And she had been sitting, her books had been sitting on my shelves for a long time, so she had to wait. And at that point, as soon as she felt, wow, now she wants a break, I jump in. She said, here I am, I've been waiting for you such a long time. So I started working on her. I did a lot of research trips. Maybe I should say something about her. Alfonsina Storni was born in 1892 in Italian-speaking Switzerland, in the Ticino, So her mother tongue was Italian, but she has nothing in Italian other than a telegram from Paris, baci a tutti, kisses for everybody, that's all. All of her writings are in Spanish. She lived 4 years in Switzerland, and then her family, here you have it again, emigrated to Argentina. Switzerland by then was a country of emigration because it was poor, rural. That wasn't a very poor family. There were entrepreneurial brothers. I mean, four brothers with an entrepreneurial spirit. But they didn't have good luck in Argentina. So Alfonsina's family, in the closest sense, they became poor, very poor. And Alfonsina moved into Buenos Aires, and she was a very independent young woman, became a journalist, a poet, a playwright. Stage theater, became a docent in a theater school for adults and for children. So she's a pioneer too in children theater, non-ideological theater. I mean, that's quite a big thing in the late 20s, early 30s. There were other children theaters strands in Europe. In America, I wouldn't know, but in Europe there were, but they were ideological on the left side. She did not have that. Yes, and so, and she died in 1938. She drowned herself. She was very sick with cancer. And it was a dark time too, anyways. I mean, there were many reasons. But I mentioned the suicide because after that suicide, they made a song. And Alfonsina has always been important and known as an avant-garde woman in Latin America, one of the first ones. Long before Frida Kahlo, for example, was known. Long before. After her suicide, they made a song on the basis of her farewell poem, Voy a dormir. I'm going to sleep.
Voy a dormir. Dientes de flores, cofia de rocío, manos de hierbas. Tú, nodriza fina, tenme prestas las sábanas de rosas y el edredón de musgos encardados. Voy a dormir, nodriza mía. Acuéstame. Ponme una lámpara a la cabecera, una constelación, la que te guste. Todas son buenas. Bájala un poquito. Déjame sola. Oyes romper los brotes. Te acuna un pie celeste desde arriba y un pájaro te traza unos compases para que olvides. Gracias. Ah, un encargo. Si él llama nuevamente por teléfono, le dices que no insista, que he salido.
Alfonsina y el mar became very famous in the 80s when Mercedes Sosa came back to the country after the fall of the military dictator. And she had a welcome back concert and she sang that song. And she died a few years ago. She's still the most famous interpret. But there are many, many versions of it, also classical by Plácido Domingo or Shakira. You can look that up. That song made her world famous. And in many countries, they do know that song. They know the song, but they think maybe it's like, Suzanne by Leonard Cohen. Who the heck is Suzanne? This Suzanne doesn't exist, but Alfonsina y el Mar, that was a historical person.
Por la blanda arena que lame el mar, su pequeña huella no vuelve más. Un sendero solo de pena y silencio llegó hasta el agua profunda. Un sendero solo de penas mudas llegó hasta la espuma. Sabe Dios qué angustia te acompañó, qué dolores viejos cayó tu voz. Para recostarte arrullada en el canto de las caracolas marinas, la canción que canta en el fondo oscuro del mar, la caracola. Te vas, Alfonsina, con tu soledad. ¿Qué poemas nuevos fuiste a buscar? Una una voz antigua de viento y de sal. Te requiebra el alma y la está llevando, y te vas hacia allá como en sueños, dormida Alfonsina, vestida.
So I started working on that, and I wanted to change. I wanted to bring her work to make her work known in Switzerland and in the German-speaking area. So I started translating her work, especially her prose, her essays, her short stories, and also her theater. And I produced a radio feature of an hour, like a narrative trip. On a trip towards to find Alfonsina, between Berlin, Ticino, Buenos Aires, even Bloomington, where I tried to find her and to reconstruct her life. And I brought out that volume with her translations in the fall 2013.
This is the My Soul Has No Sex,
exactly.
Stories, Columns, and Provocations.
Yes, exactly. I took a line from one of her letters where she was a very young woman and she wrote to a politician, a famous politician on the left, and she said, I feel with you and I'm so sorry to what happened to you, but in this moment my soul has no sex. And by that she wanted to say, yes, I'm a woman. I'm in a woman's body. And in Argentina at that time, you'd say, oh, God, they would always overflow with emotions anyways, you know. But then she said, no, this is a different kind of empathy, of emotion. I'm with you here. And now I'm writing the biography, and it comes out in November 2015, and that has the title Thistle in the Wind. That's how she called herself. The whole sentence is, I've always lived like a thistle in the wind, which is not so good in an environment that lives on facades.
Now that's in November, it's slated to come out? And you're in the midst of that one then?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what's next for you? Or is there something beyond that that you're working on?
There's something beyond that too.
Always something beyond that. What's next beyond what's next, right? Well, you use the word timeless many times throughout here, and I think it's an interesting thing to you know, think about. I think primarily too through scholarship or through people who work on particular periods of time, how we tend to always sort of hear not necessarily the same things, but it does seem like the things we work on talk to each other in interesting ways through our relationship with them, right? So do you see a sense that where you have come from does make sense as it goes through Anne-Marie Mahler? You know, is there a way that you see how your path has taken you through that project as well?
Yes, certainly. I like how you put that. And it might seem a paradox anyways in a person that works with historical material as I do, as a medievalist, because you would think, yes, the Middle Ages, that's from then and then. I think it has to do with my long time commitment to mysticism also, this concept of, I don't think that there is time. Time does not exist. And I learned that from them. They say it in very different words, and of course, in their own way, they were tied to their times. Their circumstances were historical circumstances, but yet within those, and I think the best is really Eckhart to make it clear there is no time, and trying to form that relationship with a divine sphere means leaving behind those fetters. That's your mind, actually, to think. He says, if you could stay in that moment, if you could stay in that point, in that point of view, probably, it's not really a place, but he makes clear it's not a physical place, but if you could stay in a place of your mind, of this eternal now of God, you would not age.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the
way... My mind is opening up. I think that's it. My mind is opening up.
Well, you know, I was trying to think in terms of just the images that I have of you talking about Anne-Marie and that sort of moment in her life that she narrates about, you know, where she expresses or finds a way to have a sense of self in a single moment in time in her memory.
Yeah.
To say, this is where I become who I am. And that is the timeless spot for her, in a sense, or the thing that she's either attached to, right? That's she
true.
Hasn't moved beyond that spot necessarily. But at the same time, that's her sort of now. You know, that now that here's what I can do, or here's what I will be doing.
Yeah, I like
sense.
That a lot. Yeah.
Good for me.
Leave that in.
Yeah, good for me.
That's cool.
Salve Dios, que angustia te acompañó, que dolores viejos cayó tu voz, te recosté tierra huyera en el canto de la calle con las marinas. La canción que canta en el fondo oscuro del mar, la caracola. Te vas al fondo con tu soledad, que poemas nuevos fuiste a buscar, una voz antigua de viento y de sal. Te requiebra el alma y no la estás llevando. Y te vas para allí como un sueño.
That's all the time we have tonight. Thanks to our guest, Hildegard Keller, for joining us to discuss her latest project, a film about local artist 89-year-old Anne-Marie Mahler, called Whatever Comes Next, as well as her work on medieval mystics and Alfonsina Storni, one of the most important Argentine and Latin American poets of the modernist period. Special thanks to Hildegard Keller for letting us hear parts of her film in this program. Anne Malcolm reads excerpts from the writings of Anne-Marie Mahler. Music in the film is by composer Olaf Levick and cellist Ivan Tocali. We heard two versions of Alfonsina y el Mar, one by Mercedes Sosa and one by Shakira. Next time on Interchange, What Went Wrong? Assessing Obama's Legacy. I'll speak with Yale professor David Bromwich, critic, scholar, and political essayist, who has tried and failed to find a president who has put any of his eloquent words into political action. Assessing Obama's Legacy on Interchange, Tuesdays on WFHB. This is Doug Storm. Thanks for listening. Our board engineer is Jonathan Richardson. I produce Interchange. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. Our theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Stay tuned for the Jazz Menagerie coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.